The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Travel writing, from the poles to the equator.
The best book ever written about the polar regions, without any doubt, is Apsley Cherry Garrard's The Worst Journey in the World. And that book begins with the immortal line, "Polar exploration is the cleanest way of having a bad time which has been devised." If the Antarctic's a symbol of what could be, the Arctic's a symbol of what the Earth is.
There was no cathartic awakening or joyful homecoming. No matter how much my dislike of the village had diminished and my respect for my relatives had grown, any new romanticised perspectives quickly evaporated in the steaming humidity. City like Lagos, you have up to 15 million people in this totally ungoverned city. There are hardly any traffic lights, and so people have to jostle, struggle and to fight to make their way through, whether it's physically or financially.
As you may have gathered, this week's podcast will take you to some of the hottest and coldest places on Earth. In the case of Noor Sarawiwa's new travel book Looking for Trans Wonderland, the heat is not simply climatic. It transported her back to the land of her father, Nigeria, a place where the political temperature also seems constantly on the boil. Her father, Ken Sarawiwa, was a famous campaigner for the rights of the Ogoni people to share the wealth generated by the oil being mined on their land. In particular, he wanted it spent on restoring the environmental degradation caused by the oil industry. But he upset the military government so much that they eventually executed him. Noor had been brought up and educated in England, and her father's death meant she had no interest in returning to her homeland, even though she became a travel writer specialising in Africa. Until, that is, she decided to write her first book on what she describes as my unglamorous, godforsaken motherland with its penchant for noise and disorder. She joined us here in the studio, along with Isabel Choate of the Guardian Travel Desk, and began by reading us a short passage from the book.
As I sat in a Danfo at a bus stop, a man walked past pushing a cake-laden trolley. He was drawing the attention of customers by blasting the recording of a baby's screams from loudspeakers. He sniggered at my horrified reaction. As my bus waited to fill up with passengers, a beggar hopped on board and faced the passengers. Intoning like a church pastor, he began a very long speech detailing his sad life story in Liberia. But far from drawing sympathy, the beggar's laboured, inarticulate ramblings only irritated the buck-toothed old man next to me. "I beg, what is your point?" he barked at the beggar, who snapped his mouth shut immediately. The old man angrily rummaged his pocket for some naira notes. "I'm tired of your mad talk," he muttered, before pressing hush money into the Liberian's palm. The beggar jumped off the bus, and the old man let out a disgruntled sigh. "Where are you from?" he asked me once the bus got moving. "I'm Nigerian," I said, disappointed that he'd discerned that I was a diasporan. "What makes you think I'm not?" "You don't look like a Nigerian. You dress like those YMCA girls," he said. "And I can see you staring out of the window. You are looking around curiously. You cannot come from Lagos." YMCA girl, that was a new one. Most passers-by asked me if I was a footballer because I wore running shoes all the time. We chatted all the way back to Satellite Town. We found ourselves disembarking at the same stop, walking down the same side street through the same market. It turned out the old man, his name was Julius, lived 5 minutes away from Auntie Janice. He invited me to his house for lunch.
Hello, Noor. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You've got a particularly troubled history with Nigeria. Can you tell us a bit about that background?
My relationship with Nigeria obviously started right from when I was a child. We had to go back every summer, nearly every summer. For me, with my massive wanderlust, I found that really frustrating. So obviously, as we got older and my father got more involved in his campaign against Shell, you know, he went to prison and then ultimately he was murdered by the military dictatorship. And so that really soured my relationship with Nigeria. All those events in 1995 really cemented that view that I wanted nothing to do with Nigeria. It just reminded me of really depressing and negative things.
Can you tell us a bit about what made you want to go back?
Well, I'd done so much travel around Africa in itself and to quite random countries in Africa that are off the tourist trail. And so I developed a real taste for travelling around the continent, and it got to a point where I started to look at Nigeria in a different light as a result, because I went to Ivory Coast and Guinea and Togo and Benin and Gabon, Sao Tome, all these places around Nigeria within the West African region. I realised after a point, well, if I've enjoyed all these other countries, and they're so much smaller than Nigeria, Nigeria must have something to offer as well.
Much of the journey you describe is frustrating, challenging, but there are also beautiful places too. What were the highlights of the journey for you?
In terms of like tourism and beauty, the Cross River State in the southeast of the country was amazing. It's a well-run state. They've made a real effort to attract tourists. And so you've got rainforests that have been preserved, and you have chimpanzees and gorillas and drill monkeys, which are a species of monkeys that are only found really in Nigeria. And they're beautiful. They're like these, they look like baboons, grey baboons, but they've got this amazing like pink and blue, bright blue fur on their buttocks. I also love the north. You've got the Durbar Festival, which is held once a year, and the emir is treated to a horse parade by his loyal guards. And that was absolutely stunning. It's so beautiful. You've got hundreds of men on horses. Everyone's dressed up in shiny material, including the horses themselves. And it's just this magnificent display that I've never seen anywhere else in West Africa.
The extract you've just read shows that the book's as much about the people you meet as the places you see, your fellow bus passengers, hawkers, hotel workers, government officials. What part do these characters play in shaping your view of the country?
Well, I think without speaking to the actual people, you're not going to get a sense of what Nigeria is about. And I think that's a problem that you have in Africa generally. It's viewed from a very long distance perspective. And if you want to understand the chaos, if you want to understand the decrepitude, all the negative things, you have to actually speak to the people in order to really know why the country is the way it is, and that it actually isn't the sum of its parts, you know, because people as individuals are incredible. They have so many struggles, and you know, there are reasons for why they do what they do. And so without talking to them, you're not going to really understand what it is that makes that country tick. And so it was fascinating. In a city like Lagos, you have up to 15 million people in this totally ungoverned city. Ungoverned in the sense that there are hardly any traffic lights and that sort of thing. And so people have to jostle, they have to struggle and to fight to make their way through, whether it's physically or financially. And that in turn, you know, affects the way people behave. And you see people in a very different light when you actually talk to them on an everyday level.
When you finally find some calm, a moment in the forest, you say that you miss that chaos that initially frustrated you. Did that become one of the big attractions for you towards the end of your journey?
Yeah, I never like places that are too sterile. So even as a child, I loved Disneyland. But for me now as an adult, Disneyland is the the complete opposite of what I want out of travel. It's just, it's far too clean and sterile and artificial. So I do like that jaga-jaga, as they say in Nigeria, that sort of unpredictability and chaos. It can get a bit much sometimes, but yeah, I've always been a bit conflicted in that sense, in that I crave a sense of order and predictability, but at the same time, if I'm actually confronted with that, I do find myself getting quite bored. Nice hotels and clean, quiet air is really therapeutic up to a point. But then I do start to miss just the everyday chaos, and 'cause that's where you really learn about a country and the character of the people.
And was that part of what made you feel quite disorientated?
I think that was more in the north. I mean, obviously, having been raised in England, you do feel slightly different from everyone in the country on some level. But, you know, I identify very strongly as a Nigerian. So in the north, it's different because people, they speak different languages. It's predominantly Hausa, the language they speak. And it's Islamic, and I come from a Christian background. And so you have a real, you feel very, very different. And Nigeria always has been a country of two halves, in a sense. You've got this southern, tropical, largely Christian south, and then this dry, Islamic north. Being in the north of Nigeria is, for me, almost no different from being in Mali or Burkina Faso.
Do you recommend Nigeria as a travel destination? I mean, do you recommend it to your friends in England as a place to visit?
I would, but it depends on who they are and their character. You have to be an adventurous person. And I think you have to enjoy travel from an anthropological perspective, because that's what you're going to get out of travel in Africa. People who travel, but they, you know, they want easy attractions. They want their Taj Mahals. They want to be easily bedazzled. And you're not going to get that necessarily in a country like Nigeria. It's just as fascinating as anywhere else in the world, but you have to have a genuine interest in human culture and human behaviour and music. So you have to, you know, dig a little deeper and think more deeply. But if you're a bit of more of a Philistine and you want giraffes and Taj Mahals and all that sort of thing, then Nigeria's not the place for you.
So did you feel like you were writing a travel book?
I mean, I personally wanted to see another side of Nigeria that I wasn't familiar with, because as a child, I always had to go back to my hometown. And apart from one trip when I was 12 with my father, where he took us around the country, we generally stayed in Port Harcourt, where I'm from. It was just a whole other side to Nigeria that I wanted to see, but I also felt the world needed to see as well. Because you never hear anything about Nigeria unless it's to do with oil or, these days, bombings in churches. And so it was important for me to see that, but also important by extension for the world to see that too.
Thanks, Isabel and Noah. Noah, I grew up in Nigeria, so I have a couple of personal questions to ask you. There is a colonial tradition of literature about going into the heart of Africa. I mean, most obviously Conrad, although that was fiction, but also Graham Greene's Journey Without Maps. He talks about going through the horror of the villages of Sierra Leone and Liberia. It's a journey to himself. Were you conscious of this tradition when you were writing this book?
Oh, definitely. I've read a few travel books on Africa written by Europeans, and some of them are really good, but there's always that sense that they're not quite connected to the people. I felt that there's a certain sense of humour in Africa that wasn't really being drawn out in these books, and you definitely feel a cultural gap. If a 60-year-old white Northern American male is talking to a 21-year-old African female, for example, she's not going to relate to him in quite the way she relates to me. And so I felt that as an African, albeit an African raised in the West, I felt that I could establish a kind of connection with people and write about it in a way that I felt was missing.
Now, one of my absolutely sharpest memories was getting off the plane at Kano Airport, and it felt like walking out of a fridge into an oven. Do you have those sense memories?
Oh, definitely. For me, I was landing in Port Harcourt, my hometown in the south. And so it was like loads of palm trees everywhere. And you'd step out of the plane and you were just hit by this wall of humidity and this that vegetation, you know, the smell of vegetation, which I love now. But as a child, I felt, oh, God.
And that brings us neatly to our two other guests, the travel writer Sarah Wheeler, two of whose best-known books deal with extreme cold, and Sarah Crown, editor of the book's website, who's been known to do the odd spot of armchair travelling, I think. Sarah, your most recent book's The Magnetic North, Notes from the Arctic Circle. But you've also written about the other end of the globe in Terra Incognita, which you did when you were much younger. Mm. And in between, you slipped in a biography of Apsley Cherry Gerard, who was a member of Scott's expedition to the South Pole, the fated one in 1910 to 1912. Why do you keep going back to these godforsaken places?
Well, let me tell you first of all that when The Magnetic North was published, on the day it was published, my son, who knows how many years I've spent working on the polar region, said to me, "How do you feel, Mum, today? Your book's out." And I thought, well, he said, "What's your primary emotion?" And I thought about it and I said, "Well, you know, I'm relieved there's only two polar regions." And he said, "You know what, Mum, they call it the Himalaya the third pole." I said, "I wish you hadn't said that." I mean, to answer your question, in people's minds, of course, the two polar regions are the same. But in fact, they're completely different. And I was first attracted to the Antarctic, as you say, when I was much younger. It's the only unknown place in the planet, and it seemed to me that's extraordinarily potent, a symbol for a writer. It's unknown, there's no pollution, there's no wars. I mean, literally, it's like the whole planet was before we mucked it up. And young writers should be interested in idealism and symbols of what could be. And to me, the Antarctic was a symbol of just that, of everything that we could be, of potential. You know, as Shackleton said, we all have our own great white south. And I wasn't remotely interested in the Arctic at that time because, first of all, the Antarctic is a continent, so it's very clearly defined. Whereas the Arctic, I mean, where does it start? Where does it finish? Nobody knows. It's fragmented. People own it. And the worst thing of all is people live there. There's lots of people getting in the way. That was the most wonderful thing about the Antarctic, and that one's completely loose to one's cultural moorings and from everybody else's as well. And the people are sort of have been dragged into the cash economy in various ways and tend to be very unhappy. And it's just absolutely ghastly. But as the years went by between those two books, I wrote lots of other books, including one, as you know, set in East Africa, to warm up for a little while. That was the idea of that. I started looking north and, you know, the Arctic really suits much more the sort of elegiac melancholy of middle age because of those reasons. If the Antarctic's a symbol of what could be, the Arctic's a symbol of what the Earth is. And I think if one learns anything as one gets, was 50 wizards past, it's that there aren't any answers. The best you can hope for is to ask the right questions. And I found the sort of fragmentation and doubt and unhappiness a much more uplifting medium, really, for a writer perhaps at the wrong end of my career. And I found that I think it's a writer's duty to have hope. So finding redemption in all that horror, which is what the Arctic's really about. So they do balance one another out in a way. And after all, that's how they got their names, the Arctic and the Antarctic, because the ancient Greeks sensed that there had to be one to balance the other. Arctos is the bear, it's named after the star, Antiarctos. So they are a pair, but they are polar opposites.
It's obviously quite topical at the moment because next week is the centenary of Scott's arrival at the pole, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there's a really a rather sort of touching footnote to this, which is that there's an exhibition at the moment at the Scott Polar Research Institute in Cambridge, which features his diary.
Yeah.
And they're going to turn the page.
One of the reasons that Scott became the mythic figure that he is in the British public imagination, completely eclipsing Shackleton and all the others, certainly until our own time. Well, there's lots of reasons for that, but one reason is Scott was a fantastic writer. I don't know where that came from. There's not really such a thing as a natural writer, but he's about as close as one could wish. And as the diary moves towards this inexorable, as it seems, conclusion, and he himself knew it was inexorable in the last weeks, it takes on this sort of paused, pure quality of the landscape itself, of sort of bereft of everything except the most pure kinds of expression. And it's the most extraordinarily moving document. I mean, it still brings tears to my eyes no matter how many times I read it. And that really burned itself into the public imagination. And Scott is one of the most famous Englishmen ever to have lived. And of course, it was particularly poignant because it was all about ideals and so on. And it was just before the war. So it was the last time Englishmen could believe in that kind of stuff because all those ideals, you know, were shattered in the trenches. So I think that that's partly why the power of the diary is that Scott managed to emerge from the tragedy into something bigger than all of that. And as as Cherry Garrard said, you know, there's no such thing as failure. It's the response of the spirit. Only in one superficial sense do they fail. There's also something else quite English about it, which is that we kind of like prefer our heroes dead. And that was Shackleton's big mistake, coming back alive.
There's a nice line from Cherry Garrard, which is, "This journey has beggared our language. No words could express its horror." It struck me that this ties in a lot with the way that Africa is written about as well, isn't it? There's a sense of horror that has often been associated with it, Noor.
Yeah, it's kind of portrayed almost like a tropical Antarctica, you know, where there's almost very little human life in some senses. That's how you feel, which I always feel, you know, is doing Africa a real injustice in that there is so much going on in the continent. For me, it's the very opposite of Antarctica. There's so much topography, there are different altitudes, there are different cultures, thousands of different cultures. There's so much going on. And I felt, as a travel writer in Africa, it was really important for me to portray Nigeria in that way, because I think Africa is imagined in the mind of non-Africans as this kind of tropical Antarctica.
Sarah, did it take you, when you were writing about Africa, did it take you to a very different part of your imagination?
As Noor says, you know, there's this great fecundity of life of all kinds, particularly in Kenya that I was writing about, whereas the Antarctic is biological haiku in the middle. It really is. There's life around the outside, but it's a place 1.5 times the size of the United States, and there is no life. It doesn't support any kind of life at all. And that does sort of, I think, have the opposite effect of those hot and very fecund from a human point of view, and lots of people doing lots of different things, lots of different cultures. And I think that sort of that paused nature, I think, takes you to a sort of non-human part of the imagination. One's thinking about, I mean, people always talk about the Antarctic like a spiritual power station. People who've been there, all kinds of people, even people not, you know, big, grizzly, frozen beards, not usually prone to that kind of emotional language. And I think it does elevate the spirit, because it does raise you above the human plane. So, you know, as Gertrude Stein said about somewhere else, you know, paradise, if you can stand it.
Forest can do that to you, can't it, Noor, too?
Yeah, I find for some reason when I go to a rainforest, I do have this kind of spiritual feeling. It's odd. I don't know what it is, especially early in the morning, and there's the mist, and you almost start to believe in all the folklore surrounding forests. You know, you can believe that there are spirits there. And I don't know what it is. It's something about, you know, nature, and when it's that pure and it's that beautiful and it seems so serene.
Yeah, not in it. It's not, very yeah. itchy, isn't it?
When you're
itchy
in it, it's a completely different story, yeah. But, you know, in a car, up on a hill, and it's just this rolling green canopy, and there's mist, and it sparkles. You know, there's a sort of shininess to it. The light is different.
Now, I want to, at this point, to bring in Sarah Crown, who, as I said earlier on, is more of an armchair traveller, I think,
yes.
whose regular journeys tend to involve plying between London and the northeast of England. tell us a little bit about how this resonates in your reading life, what we've been talking about.
It's interesting, as we've been talking and I've been listening to what both of you have been saying, I wondered whether all of us either plump for hot or cold as our sort of imaginative place that we go to. And I think certainly for me, I'm much more of a cold weather reader. I much prefer reading about the cold places and the ice and the snow, and that sort of space I find kind of more sort of imaginatively yielding than probably the hot places. And then I, you know, obviously then my mind wandered and I thought, why is that? But I quite like to do a straw poll on the site and see whether people agree or not. But yeah, certainly for me, when I read travel books, I tend to go for books that are about the cold, the dark. Often I went through a real phase of reading kind of extreme climbing and sailing books for no particularly good reason, but just because I think that there's something in us that desperately wants that sort of risk. In the same way as, you know, you were talking about the forest and the place that that has in our minds as children. And I think in the same way that when you're reading fairy tales, there is a psychological purpose that the forest fulfills there. It's a space of exploration that is safe. And that we can, you know, we can go out into it and then return safely in it, so it allows us to sort of fulfil that function. And I kind of think that travel writing has that function for adults as well. We want to experience that kind of risk and excitement, but we want to do it. Well, I want to do it in a safe way. Obviously, you two actually go and do it, which is completely different. But yeah, I think it does have that function for readers.
There's a new travel history, actually. I don't know whether you know of it, just out from Bodleian, which is by Peter Whitworth. And it's a sort of a survey history of travel writing. And he talks about the narrative of discovery and endurance amid savage landscapes and how important that is, particularly in the 20th century. In a way, you're both coming from opposite sides to this same issue, aren't you, Noor and Sarah Wheeler?
Africa in some ways, it's written about a lot and it's written very well, but I still feel that it's a final frontier in a sense, and the cultures haven't been explored that fully. I feel like the world lags behind slightly in the sense that people like to focus on the very rural, traditional cultures, you know, the Maasai's dressed in red and that kind of thing. But there's a modern urban culture in Africa, and I feel that that's often overlooked. And so, you know, Africa is a real, for me, it's still that sort of new frontier that's worth exploring, whereas the rest of the world has been explored massively.
I think a good travel book takes one out of oneself, but it also should take one into oneself as well. So it's showing you an external landscape, but what it's really doing, I mean, certainly from my own reading experience, all my own sort of pantheon of travel books, they're really taking you inside of yourself as well. I mean, all literature has got really is what it is to be human. What else is there to write about? And I think that travel books, travel literature, good travel literature, deploys the landscape in order to fulfil that end. And I think that certainly in the polar regions, that affected me quite a lot when I set about writing about it myself, because almost everything written before, I think everything written before, in the case of the Antarctic, had been written by men. And there's a certain male vision of that kind of extreme landscape, which sort of perceives it like another mammoth to be clubbed to death outside the cave. It's got to be conquered. You know, and in our own day, it's what I call the frozen beards, because that's why they appear always on the cover of the book, with an iced-up beard, and they've pulled the sledge across. And, you know, good for them, I certainly couldn't do it. But it's all about seeing how dead you can get, or about how slow the other guy was. And that's fine, that's one way of going about things. So I'm not interested in that. And I didn't do anything remotely brave at all. I spent 7 months in the Antarctic and flew around in helicopters, and I did, you know, put up my tent, but I wasn't enduring any hardship, although I must say, it is like sleeping inside a cutlery drawer in a freezer, because you've got to have all your kit in with you, in the sleeping bag with you to stop it freezing. But I just wanted to look at that landscape and interpret it in a different way. And I don't think that we have to see any of the extreme landscapes of the world as places to be conquered in order to portray them in words. And I think the things they have to teach us, and the best books aren't about that anyway.
Now, I'm going to move forward now onto fiction, towards fiction. You, particularly in The Magnetic North, you reference fiction quite a lot. You talk about Dickens and Chekhov and people who inhabited this with their imagination.
Yeah. Well, everywhere I go, all the books I've written about landscapes, I'm particularly interested in what writers have best conjured those landscapes. I've been writing for the past 2 years about the United States, and I've just found that absolutely wonderful, sort of for each state I've been in, trying to find the writer, like, you know, Steinbeck in California and Monterey and so on, who best conjures most faithfully, most truthfully, the landscape in which they grew up. And it's very poignant when it comes to the frontier, the unconquered land, literally, you know, the black earth of the Midwest and so on, the upper Northwest, as it used to be called. And of course, I wasn't able to do that really in the Antarctic, except for people who'd used it imaginatively. And it was very surprising how many people had. Thomas Pynchon, Tony Kushner, all kinds of people. Thomas Pynchon wrote, "You wait, everyone has an Antarctic," and who'd imagine him down there? But in the case of the Arctic, it was actual writers who'd been there. And of course, the Russians lead the field, and Chekhov made a journey right the way across Siberia to Sakhalin. It was his one foray into non-fiction, and he wrote home saying that he felt he was wearing the wrong trousers, and he conjures cold. And one thing that one does get a lot from the Russians, who did write a lot of fiction about Siberia and the Russian Far East, is it becomes very clear that cold is the natural state of the universe and heat is a luxury. I felt that very much, particularly amongst all the reindeer herders. There's 17 polar peoples in Russia alone, all with a different culture, different language.
Now, you might quibble with that, Noor, mightn't you? That heat is a luxury.
I agree. I love heat. I hate cold. I can't stand it. You know, if you're standing in the middle of the street and it's 35 degrees in Nigeria, I feel like, yes, it's hot, I'm sweating, and I'm, you know, slowly getting dehydrated, but I will live. Whereas if you stand, you know, in Antarctica, even in summer, well, for me anyway, the default direction you're going in is death. You know, I just feel like I'm dying.
Nevertheless, we've just done on the website a series of winter reads. What is really striking about it is how sentimental people are about the reading about cold, but also the reading that they do in cold weather. There's a sort of cozying upness about it, isn't there, Sarah?
It's the appeal of reading something that makes you feel cozy at wintertime. So, you know, sort of dark night, firelit, reading a ghost story. There's something very kind of comforting about that.
I must say, a lot of readers write to me about my polar books saying that they found themselves putting more and more clothes on as they were reading them.
Yeah, it has that effect, I think. But there is, yeah, we had, I guess, about sort of 20 or so of these winter reads. And over again, the feeling came through that what you're getting out of them is a sort of vicarious chill that makes you feel warmer as a result of it. And so by reading about snow and ice and being frozen in your bed and all the rest of it, you warm yourself up, you make yourself, you get the lovely shiver that is because you're in somewhere.
It's a bit like hearing ferocious rain, isn't it, when you're all cosy inside. Mm. It's always something very comforting about it.
Mm. Now, Alison Flood chose The Terror by Dan Simmons. You presumably know that, Sarah, because it's about it's reimagining the Captain Franklin's 19th century expedition to cross the Northwest Passage.
That is an expedition that will certainly warm you up. It's one of the most horrific, really, of all the little wooden ships creaking in the pincers of a floe, you know, in the heroic age of Antarctic exploration, of a polar exploration, rather. And, yeah, Franklin, as you know, sailed off with these two ships, Erebus and Terror, in order to find the Northwest Passage, which was still the grail of the age. They thought it was going to be the route to the riches of Cathay. And basically, we're never seen again. And Lady Jane Franklin sent out rescue ship after rescue ship. And then she had to send out rescue ships to rescue the rescue ships. And everybody sort of, lots of people died and everything was just horrendous. And then they all started eating one another. And it was just a ghastly saga. And in fact, we only know about all the cannibalism and so on because it was discovered many decades later and there were even bodies exhumed. But they did find some diaries and letters. So we have quite a lot of information about the Franklin expedition.
Mm-hmm. If you haven't caught up with our Winter Read series, do so. You can find it at guardian.co.uk/books. Sarah's The Magnetic North is published by Vintage, and Looking for Trance Wonderland is published by Granta. Sarah Wheeler there. Her five-part series on the men in Captain Scott's exhibition has been running on BBC Radio 4 all this week under the title To Strive and Seek. You can hear it all on Listen Again on the BBC website, bbc.co.uk/radio4. Next week, we'll move from the high adventure of world travel to the enclosed intensity of the sports field, and we'll be hearing from one of this year's Costa Prize winners, Andrew Miller. Now, Sarah Crown is still with me to tell you what else we have to look forward to over the coming week.
Yes, in the Guardian's review tomorrow, we're looking at the repercussions of the Arab Spring with an essay by the Egyptian writer Adaf Sweff, plus updates from some of the writers who wrote about it for us as it was happening this time last year. And in the Observer New Review on Sunday, we're extracting Nick Cohen's book on censorship, You Can't Read This Book, which you may remember was featured on our 2012 Look Ahead podcast a couple of weeks ago. And on the book's website, you can look out today for the first of our series of columns of ebook reviews. And next week, we'll be covering the first of this year's big poetry prizes, the T.S. Eliot Prize.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks also to Sarah Wheeler, Noor Sarah Weaver and Isabel Choate. From me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Tim Mabey, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.